tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2022, and this is episode 274, which is a conversation about a recent New York Times opinion piece called "The Anti-Abortion Movement Could Reduce Abortions If It Wanted To." On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called "Flipovic's Confused Claim That the Pro-Life Community Must Champion Contraception." And if you're a subscriber, you can access it for free at our website, equip.org. If you'd like to read this article and you're not already a subscriber, please go to equip.org to subscribe. Jay, it's good to have you on. Well, Jay is on and he's written an article that is rebutting a recent op-ed about the pro-life movement in the New York Times. But before we actually talk about the particular article, I really want to ask Jay kind of to set the stage for us, because I'm noticing, and I'm somebody who reads the New York Times regularly, almost daily, they are doing more and more, not just them, but other media outlets on abortion. Before, you know, it would just be around different election cycles that you would, you know, an article or two would pop up about abortion. But it seems like it's a real focus of coverage lately. Why is that?
Well, with Dobbs versus Jackson having been argued in December, which is the case that is going up against Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which set the paradigm for how we understand the nation's interaction on a legal level with the issue of abortion. And Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health actually puts that at risk. And that decision will be coming out in June, July. So what you're seeing, I think, is a lot of preemptive work. You mentioned before that it was an election cycle issue. I used to talk about it years ago when I first started talking, that abortion was a lot like the Olympic sports that we only cared about when the Olympics weren't, like swimming. We got all into swimming and track and field for our summer, and then we forget about it for 4 years. And abortion lived like that for most people in the United States. But that was because effectively what Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood versus Casey did was it made it so states weren't capable of passing legislation that restricted women's access to abortion. If those fall, if that will be the end result of this Supreme Court case, Dobbs versus Jackson, then it becomes a state issue and it has to be argued. So where it served the purposes of abortion supporters to keep abortion on the back burner and to not have people thinking about it, because a lot of times what you would see in the polling is that when people looked at abortion, I really looked at it, the support for abortion went down. It goes up when people aren't as worried about it or aren't thinking about it. When they really saw what was going on with abortion or became more informed about it, a lot of times you would see that support drop. And so there was a strategy to just say it's settled law and it's over and we don't have to talk about it, and to dismiss dialogue as much as possible. Well, that may be over, because if that changes this summer to the Supreme Court decision, and many people believe it's going to, at least in some way, the dynamic is going to change, then they now recognize that they have to win people on a state-by-state level to keep the abortion rights that they support. So I see this probably as just a preemptive work of trying to lay the groundwork so that when it changes, they'll have the support that they're looking for in the state level to keep those laws in effect. So places like Georgia and Texas and Mississippi, and there are states that have trigger laws in effect that are going to limit abortion immediately if Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey is no longer the law of the land. And then you have states like California, New York, places like that, Hawaii, they have trigger laws that are going to go into effect that are going to protect those rights. It's the other states, those ones where they think they can make an impact or they can sway people, that I think they're trying to lay the groundwork. So it's going to be intense. I mean, it's going to be an intense several months now of abortion becoming front and center and the way that people want to talk about it. There is no longer any benefit to anyone being quiet about it. It's the fight that has to be had now. What is abortion and what is our moral position on it as a nation?
Well, I just want to let our listeners know that because of this focus this year in 2022, it's slated that two films, one a documentary and one a drama, are coming out around Roe v. Wade and their quote unquote underground network to get women abortions when it was illegal. So stay tuned. Whenever those get released, we will be reviewing them, watching them and reviewing them, and I'll have Jay on to talk about those. But for this particular podcast, we are going to focus on an op-ed that was published in December of 2021 called "The Anti-Abortion Movement Could Reduce Abortions If It Wanted To." And it really basically is calling the pro-life movement to task that they are the ones that need to reduce abortion rate if we think that it's such a bad thing. And so I have a question for you. So this author is claiming that the abortion rate has dropped. And I know there are websites that show you like how it, every few minutes it ticks up how many abortions have been done in the United States. But how much has the abortion rate dropped in the U.S. and, you know, recently, in recent years? And when did this decline begin?
Well, the author wants to focus on, the author, Jill Filipovic, she wants to all focus on the idea of from 2011 to 2017. That is the period of decline that she's interested in discussing. There was a decline from about 1,058,000 abortions in 2011 reported, marker, down to 862,000 in 2017. So that's it's a slightly steeper decline than what we've seen. And in that, she wants to argue using data and inferences gathered from Guttmacher, which is the statistical arm of Planned Parenthood, the nation's largest abortion provider, that it is contraception and increased access to contraception that was seen as a result of the Affordable Care Act. But here's the thing. When you talk about has there been a decline? Yes, there has. And in 2011 to 2017, was there a steepening of that decline? Yeah, there was. I mean, it did become more rare in the sense of if you talk from a million down to 862,000. But that decline started back in 1989. So we've seen the declining rate. What you see, if you look at a chart, and they're very easy to find, by the way, Guttmacher does a great job at charting and graphing their statistics. You can look at a graph that they have available. Even if you go to Wikipedia, there's a graph available that you'll look where you'll see in 1973, when Roe v. Wade is decided, you see an immediate going from about 750,000 a year abortions. It just keeps going up and up and up every year until peaks somewhere close to 1.7 million a year in 1989. And then it starts to decline. Then we see this decline start. And that decline is going pretty consistently. There's a little blip here and there, like in 2005, 2006, you see a blip where it goes up again and then it starts to come back down. So what they're doing is they're focusing on a really small part of the decline and trying to, I guess, kind of weaponize it a little bit against the, not a little bit. They're weaponizing against the pro-life movement, saying, well, the reason we think the decline steepened during this part is a reason that you don't like. And if you really cared about ending abortion, you would support this, these measures, and talking about contraception, other things like that. And so, yes, there is a decline. Yes, the decline did get slightly steeper from 2011 to 2017. But there is also a decline in general that starts in 1989. And we see that decline going all the way through to today. We don't have data that's going to be coming out about what happened during COVID. There are a lot of people that are that believe, but once we get the COVID data in, we're going to see that it might have gone back up during COVID, that we saw an increase again for the first time in a long time in abortion rates.
Now, you just were talking about that, you know, obviously this author is pointing out the decline of abortions, but she really is positing that it's most possibly explained by access to contraception. And that's kind of a focus, you know, as you said, Planned Parenthood is one of the biggest providers of abortion. And one of their other focuses, their part of their mission statement is to provide, you know, easy access to contraception. And so do you think that that is true, that you can draw that line from the decline of abortions because of the access that Planned Parenthood and others give to contraception to women seeking it?
It's really difficult to know why the abortion rate has declined. And what is most probable is a collection of a lot of different things happening at once. Because there is data that we get from Oregon and specifically the Pacific Northwest that when IUDs became much, IUDs was a very expensive form of contraception, comparatively speaking to barrier methods like condoms that in New York, like literally gives away for free all over the place as part of a, you can go into barber shops and find bowls of condoms as a part of a public health process that they were going through. So with, you see that when IUDs became readily available, there was a decline in unplanned pregnancies, right? I guess that makes sense. If you have a contraception like an IUD that works at the level of about 99%, and it's a long term, and it's inserted into a woman and implanted into her uterus and just stays there for years and years and years, then you're going to see a group that has effectively temporarily sterilized themselves have a decrease in pregnancy. But that doesn't explain the full arc. As I said, if you want to cherry pick the years and say from 2011 to 2017, the reason that we saw a steepening in that decrease is because Affordable Care Act made it possible for people to get access to types of contraception they didn't have access to before. Sure, maybe that's a part of what happened there. Maybe that's an explanation for why things sped up a little bit. But that offers no explanatory power as to why it started to decrease in 1989 and went on this continuing decrease. So there has to be other factors. To say it must be this is because you picked a part of the arc of decrease that you like the most and that will be most effective for making your argument that it's all on contraception. That's not possible. The decrease has to be multifaceted. The reasons have to be all over the board. It could be, and some of the things that a general distaste as the population has increased, fewer people want to get abortions because fewer people like abortions. It's more difficult to get them because doctors don't like to perform them and more medical professionals and nurses don't want to have anything to do with it. There's a lot of things that play into state laws that restrict access to abortion, which a couple of years ago we were being told by all of them that this was certainly the reason that abortion numbers were dropping. And now that it's politically expedient to ignore that, they're saying, no, it's contraception. So there's so many factors at play here that I don't think you can look at that and say that is the reason, because they have cherry-picked a series, a 2011 to 2017 period, and just ignored 1989 to 2010.
Unfortunately, Clever Joe did not get back to us by January 31st to claim his prize that he won with the giveaway that ended last December for a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. So we're going to spin that wheel again. Here we go. The winner is Dixie Morgan. Dixie Morgan, if that is you, you have 2 episodes to claim your subscription to the Christian Research Journal. That's a complimentary subscription by contacting us at webmaster@equip.org. Now, if Dixie doesn't contact us within 2 episodes, we will go ahead and spin that wheel again. There were only 6 people that were in the giveaway now. And so for the next giveaway, you want to be one of those people that we will enter into our next giveaway, which will have more swag than just the subscription. Now, Dixie can extend their subscription to the Christian Research Journal, or if they are not already a subscriber, they'll get a subscription, or they can gift it to a friend. So thanks for everybody that was so kind to enter into the contest and also give us that rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Now, there are thousands of downloads that we get, so I know that there's still a lot of people who never got around to giving us a rating or review, and they will do that the next time we have the giveaway. So thanks to everybody who entered in. And also, I just want to encourage you to get the word out every time I say this, but really it means so much to us if you just tell a friend about this podcast or forward on in an email or post in on social media your favorite episodes. That really helps us out a lot and helps other people discover the podcast and also all the resources on our website, equip.org. If you're not already a subscriber and want to read the article that Jay has written for us, responding to the critique by Flipovic in the New York Times, it is exclusive online subscriber content, and that's available to our subscribers. So please go to equip.org and at magazine, go to the subscription tab where you can subscribe to our magazine. And if a subscription is not in your budget right now, we're so grateful for tips. You can just tip us a really small amount. Everything matters. $3, $5, $10. Do that by going to Postmodern Realities. And when you click on that, that's under the magazine tab there. You can go to any of the landing pages that you like, and you will find a link to give us a tip. So thank you for partnering with us, for helping us to bring you this particular episode and all the episodes, and helping us to get the word out so that we can equip the body of Christ with all of our content. It's interesting that you mention the contraception method of IUD, because that's exactly the illustration that they use in the New York Times. It's kind of like this IUD with a condom at the bottom and all kinds of birth control pills around, and also some of the ones that, you know, you can get into your arm for a long periods of time, I think. But anyway, Flipovic, you know, she's claiming that, this is what she actually says, that pro-life groups, quote, oppose full and free access to effective contraceptives, and many adamantly oppose them. So two questions. Do pro-life groups adamantly oppose access to contraceptions? And by the way, those wouldn't just be at Planned Parenthood, that, you know, birth control is easily, you know, like you were mentioning condoms, you can get that at your local drugstore or, you know, store, Walmart, Target, whatever. And also through your doctor, your primary care, not even a OBGYN. So do they adamantly oppose them? And if they do, why would they take that position?
One of the things I found objectionable to her language is using the term many, and is a, when she says many adamantly oppose them. And she, by the way, she provides a hyperlink on that so you can go to see the support that she's offering for the term many oppose them. And it goes back to a 10-year-old New York Times piece about Charmaine Yost when she was the head of Americans United for Life. Like, that's not helpful, right? I mean, that doesn't prove any or demonstrate anything about today. But it is true. There is a truth that many pro-life groups adamantly oppose contraception. Now, the problem is that there's no one reason for that, right? I mean, the Catholic Church and the Catholic leadership oppose it because they have spiritual and theological grounds in which they approach this question. It's not an idea of how it works in the sense of any particular mechanism within contraception that they oppose. They believe that sex is a unifying act, that it is procreative by nature, and that when you frustrate that procreative nature of it and you take away that unifying nature of it between the man and the woman in a married relationship, it reduces it to something that is just for fun, a pleasure principle, and it takes away something significant about it. It takes it out of the context that God meant it for. So that's why the Catholic Church doesn't like contraception, the Catholic Church leadership, although she provides evidence and is polling that Catholic laity doesn't care about it at all, that they support the use of contraception. So that's one reason. They have theological grounds, and they have spiritual grounds that they object to this. Then the other would be a group of pro-lifers who are convinced that there is an abortifacient mechanism within many types of contraception. And so they have a moral objection to it because they believe that it is a different type, or it could possibly be a different type of abortion. If human life begins at conception or fertilization, and then the implantation is frustrated by some mechanism without a contraception, then they believe that that is a participation in an abortion. And then, by the way, you have pro-lifers, progressive pro-lifers, like Teresa Brkanovic, who runs a progressive against abortion organization, who support this. And then you have a bunch of pro-lifers out there who don't have any view on this whatsoever. You have people like Rich Papard, who used to write a lot for Christian Research Journal, who's written articles arguing against this idea that many forms, not all of them, but that many forms of contraception are abortifacient in nature. So it's not a monolithic group. You can't look at pro-lifers and say, you guys are all against contraception. It is also true. She's right when she says that many are, and she's also right when she says that many adamantly oppose it. It's just the percentage of who that many are and their reasons for why they oppose it vary even within the pro-life community. So it's a bit more complicated and a bit more divided within the pro-life community than she is pointing out.
So how do you respond to the claim that the reason why that pro-life groups, oppose government-sponsored contraception access, you know, for example, to Planned Parenthood, is because really, the goal of the pro-life movement isn't to save the unborn, but they really want to control women's bodies. They want to have, women cannot have control over their own bodies and their own choices about contraception.
It is a weird claim if you're active in the pro-life movement today, right? I mean, I think that would have been an effective ad hominem attack at the pro-life movement, more effective a generation ago. When it was dominated by men, right? But Now, if you look at all of the major organizations within the pro-life movement, so many of them are run by outspoken and powerful women, educated, hyper-successful. We're talking about doctors, we're talking about lawyers, we're talking about community organizers, people that started this when they were in college and worked their way up to run national organizations. We're talking about people who worked in the medical profession and now are moving over to become a part of this movement to fight against abortion. We're talking about atheists. Across the board, all of these different groups of women, powerful women, are coming together to lead the pro-life movement. Now, there still are obviously male voices, and I don't obviously, as a man within the pro-life movement, think that male voices ought to diminish, but it would be foolish not to recognize the level of power and influence within the pro-life movement that women have. Even if you go beyond those national organizations, start to go into communities, which I get to do, where I go into all of these communities and I see all these pregnancy centers all over the country and talk to the people who run these pregnancy centers, almost all of them women, and some of the most impressive women that come out of that community to organize these places that try to find a Christ-like way to meet the needs of women and families that are facing unexpected pregnancies so that they can encourage them towards life-affirming decisions. The idea that all of these women are anti-women or anti-woman by their very nature is a bizarre claim to me. I understand the cash they can get from it as far as motivating their base and to take away the need to engage the actual arguments that are being posed by the pro-life side so that they can paint with a broad brush this entire group of people of being anti-women, anti-women's choices. We don't want them to have fun having sex, which is one of the things that I've heard people say. Like, I care, right? This is a question of how we treat other human beings and what the government endorses by law and whether or not we should be able to destroy innocent human life. And then it's a question of, in those places where the government has made allowances for things that I am morally against, how much I am going to be required as an individual within this country to participate in things I find morally reprehensible. And I don't think the government should compel me or other people or organizations or churches or anybody else to be a part of something that violates some basic principles of how we believe other human beings ought to be treated and how we approach some of the most important questions about human beings, or sexuality being one of those questions. So I think it's a strange charge. I think it's an ad hominem. I think it's meant to dodge discussion. There's no evidence for it. As a matter of fact, the evidence is strong that women are making decisions about what they morally want within the culture that they live in on their own. And you have women opposing each other. I think that's more what's going on right now, to the point that you have people like Joy Behar going on TV on The View, which show, I think it's the name of the show. I don't watch, but I saw recently that she says that Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett is not a woman because of her positions, right? And we've seen this before. They're not women because they support this idea. I think it's a bizarre charge. It has more to do with trying to not have to engage the actual arguments. And I think it was probably something that would have worked more effectively a long time ago. I think nowadays it doesn't even make sense anymore because so much of the power, so much of the influence, so much of the voice, so much of the commitment, so much of the resources that are generated for the pro-life movement are coming from powerful, intelligent, successful women. It would be weird to believe that they all are against women.
So does opposition to what the author terms comprehensive sex education actually give her support for her claim about pro-life motivations? I mean, because again, it's the same thing that pro-life people are mostly religious people who are against comprehensive sex education because it goes against their religious teaching.
Again, I think what you see in this particular op-ed is what we call a cumulative case argument attempting to be made, right? And how a cumulative case argument works is that I line up multiple lines of evidence and say that any one of these lines of evidence by themselves is not persuasive enough to make my point. But as we see the accumulation of evidence gather, as you put them together, they make a powerful case. But if these lines of evidence are actually weak, or if they're misrepresentative, they don't help make a cumulative case. And that's what we're seeing here. Like every time we look at something that Filipovic has said, we see that it's not exactly as she's portraying it. And I think here again, as she tries to say objection to the school system having the freedom to give what they consider comprehensive sex education demonstrates that we're more religiously motivated, as you said. We're more maybe shy about talking about these things, not understanding where the culture is, not getting that these kids are going to have sex. That's not why most people that I talk to object to the government teaching sex ed. It's not that we are prudish. It's that sexual values are an important part of what you teach somebody as they grow up. And the government isn't just teaching the biology of sex through schools, or schools aren't just teaching the biology of sex, which I think is probably okay with most people, how biologically it works. They're teaching values of sex. And that's something that's where this idea of comprehensive sex education, it's not teaching women about their bodies. You go to our pregnancy center, our local pregnancy center, completely Christian run. One of the things that they do when they bring these young women in who are facing unexpected pregnancies, they counsel them, they teach them, they offer them classes. And one of those classes is to tell them how their body works. And we're stunned at how many of them don't understand that. So it's not the biological aspect of it. It's the value aspect of it. And I think you see, if somebody's having a hard time understanding why certain groups of people don't want the values of other organizations or other people being taught to their kids, you've seen that play out a little bit in Northern California in the last several months, right? Where you have articles or news stories being released about a mother suing her school because she was blindsided by her school when she was called in and her seventh grader was identifying now as a boy, and that she had been encouraged by these teachers that she was both bisexual and now transgender and was wanting to transition from a girl to a boy and wanted to be called a boy's name and dress as a boy. And she talked about the emotional, how she felt about that. But then when COVID put them at home, she saw her daughter transition back in a sense psychologically and emotionally to the girl that she knew before. And so she started looking into it. And we've seen other things where you find out that the schools are actively pushing particular agendas about who we are and what we are as sexual beings on kids. And hiding them from their kids. So she sued because two teachers had taught her daughter to something about herself and then also asked the daughter not to share it with the mother. Now, the lawsuit's still in process and the investigation's being done. But even just using that not as an example, anything more than just to say, I think that people have been given a reason to not exactly trust what's going on when people say, we'll handle teaching your kids about sex. I don't need you or anybody else to handle teaching my kids about sex. We are frank and honest with our kids about how sex works, about the dangers of it, about the good parts about it, about everything. We are capable of having that conversation. We take it very seriously as parents. And so the idea that we're being told that you don't do a good enough job, so we have to do it for you, it's again, you come up against with someone who takes the positions oftentimes that this author takes, that if the government's not doing it, it's not being done. And that's not true. We see this sort of accusation a lot. Well, if we're not doing it in schools, it's not being done. Hogwash. I do it in my house all the time. If we're not taking care of this charitable giving, it's not being done. No, it's being done by private organizations. It is being taken care of. And so there is a tension there, I think. So when they say, well, you don't want comprehensive sex education, you want to keep teaching lies. No, we just don't want you teaching our kids some of the most important values of life. There's things I want you to teach them if I send my child to school with you. And there's things that our family should be teaching them. And I think it's important. I think sex education is vitally important. I just don't think that it's the kind of thing that most people feel comfortable turning over or outsourcing to others because there's so much about value and personal belief that's tied up into it that's inescapable. As I've even heard, you know, Jordan Peterson once talked about how, in a question that was asked about it, sex is an incredibly complicated thing with so many spiritual and emotional levels to it, but just say nothing of the biological complexities that come along with it. It's not a matter that we don't take it seriously. It's a matter we take it so seriously, we just don't want to outsource it to other people. So it's not evidence that we're against women or against sex. It's not evidence that we take sex seriously enough that we don't want other people teaching our kids about it. We want the freedom to teach it ourselves.
Another line of evidence in Flipovic's argument is that President Trump cut Title X funding to organizations who actively counseled women to abortion as an option. I want to read this direct quote from her op-ed about this. She writes, quote, "Conservatives are already going after contraception. adds President Donald Trump's slash funding to teenage pregnancy prevention and research, and barred Title X federal family planning funds from going to organizations that told women their legal options in pregnancy. President Biden refers to that rule, but not before a quarter of health clinics were forced to drop out of the Title X program. In 2020 alone, the number of patients served by Title X grants declined by a whopping 2.4 million, end quote. So I have a question for you. Does this negatively impact at-risk groups more than others and exacerbate the problem, as Flipovic claims?
I think this is a really interesting point. I try as much as I can to find authors who disagree with me so that I can evaluate different things. And I read what I thought was a very, of all places, this is going to sound awful because I don't have anything, I don't look in her stuff very much, but on Oprah Daily, there was a lovely article that called "This Is How the American Healthcare System Is Failing Black Women," and it talks and it gets into some of the Title X funding things. And so there's no doubt when you read the experiences of women of color that there's a difference in how the medical they sense or experience a difference in how they're treated by the medical system, right? And so there are dynamics that are played within certain communities, the Latino community and the Black community in the United States, that exist between them and the medical industry that don't seem to exist in other groups in the same way. So I think that there are obviously things when you read about the experiences that other people are having, that they have a different relationship with the medical community, and it's not easy to understand what's going on there. And so I say all that to say I understand this question. But let's get into what happened with the Title X restrictions. First of all, I've read multiple articles from people that are on the side of the position that the Title X restrictions were bad. But the problem is that much of the data that they point to that says that this is the conditions that are going on in the world, they were going on while Title X grants were pouring out. The data that they're using to say that these women are lacking access to them things were data that was gathered while Title X grants were out there, and they've been out there for 50 years, right? So it wasn't like they're pointing to that period where they weren't there. You can't point to that period right now. We don't have the data from that period. They're pointing to other periods. So it's not clear that that was doing the job that they wanted it to begin with. But here's the thing I think that's most interesting. When Title X grants that were going to these organizations that provided this kind of sexual wellness care to communities, particularly communities at risk communities or communities that have different relationships with the medical community, the Title X restrictions were to say, you can get the grants to keep doing all of these things that you're doing as long as you don't counsel people towards abortion or provide abortions. We just want to separate the Title X grants from that aspect, right? So you can look after the sexual wellness of your community. You just can't do this. These are not, by the way, restrictions that are odd. And what I mean by that is if you've ever talked to organizations that are Christian organizations that take money from the government to fund certain things, like there's a homeless ministry in our area. They take money from the government to provide service to the homeless community in our area here. When they're providing the services that the government funds, they cannot deliver the gospel. They cannot reach out to those people on behalf of their religious mission. The government insists that those things be separated. These kind of divisions do happen. So in this particular one, the Title X grants were said, you can have the money to look after the sexual wellness of your community, but you can't have it and counsel towards and perform abortions at the same time. And so when she says, or when they say, well, that shut down all of the access that these people had to those Title X grants, and in many cases made it difficult for places to run, that's because those organizations who are so angry about apparently conservatives and pro-lifers not providing for contraception and sex education and the sexual wellness of these communities outside of our problems with abortion, those organizations that ceased to get Title X made the decision that they were more about abortion, or at least abortion was essential to what they were doing. so that they wouldn't give it up, and they lost those Title X funds. But Planned Parenthood was not hurt by this. It's whatever they want to claim. I mean, they'd had record fundraising, by the way, during that time. They were able to leverage these sorts of things for massive gifts from celebrities and authors and donors from all over the world. So it was a decision made by the organization not to separate themselves from counseling or performing abortions. And so that was why they lost Title X. If they didn't want to do that, they could have had all of that Title X grant money and continued to look after the sexual wellness. So oddly enough, this particular charge feels like physician heal thyself from my side when I look at it. I was like, you're the one that's accusing us of being too hung up on contraception that we won't support it, which you say will limit abortions. But on the other hand, you're so hung up on abortion that you would rather die on that hill than provide the resources you can provide to communities through these grants.
So tell us a little bit about the Supreme Court decision in 2014, Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. Did they use religious exemptions to deny women access to contraception through their employee health care benefits? And thus, you know, again, really, you know, not allow women to have control over their own bodies, even at their place of employment.
Yeah, this is, again, part of that cumulative case she's trying to make. She's bringing all these different strands of arguments together to say, look, there is a track record here. The problem is that if you go to the link that she provides to talk about Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, it goes to the Supreme Court page, and you look at the Supreme Court does a great job now. It's so much easier the way they organize their information online. If you ever are interested in what's going on in that particular case, you can go, and the Supreme Court will have the case, a summary of the case. They'll have links to the full decisions or the full, and then they'll show you everything that has been released about that case in a little section of press releases. And then they'll also give you access to all the amicus briefs that you can read that were filed with the Supreme Court. They do a wonderful job. And one of the first links that they have when you go to the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby is, what do we do after Burwell versus Hobby Lobby? And it tells you immediately that the government's response to this decision, and here's what that decision made. Hobby Lobby was being told under the Affordable Care Act, and others too, but Hobby Lobby became the poster child for this, that they were going to have to supply contraceptives that in their mind, that they believed, that they had evidence to believe, were abortifacient by nature. That they were as a company, were going to have to pay for somebody to use something that would violate deeply held religious beliefs about the value of human life and when life begins and what destroys life. And so what the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby case decided was what they called closely held private companies of a certain size were closely held private companies were allowed to have religious exemptions for this kind of provision. They were allowed to say, look, I can't provide in particular IUDs or the morning after pill, because that was the two things I believe that Hobby Lobby, they were going to give you all sorts of other contraception. They were going to cover all these other areas of contraception. We're not going to cover IUDs. We're not going to cover the morning after pill because we believe those are problematic and they don't work within our religious belief system. And so what the Supreme Court said was, okay, you don't have to. If you're a closely held private organization, you don't have to do that if it violates your conscience. And the United States' response to that, the government's response was, when any organization files for that religious exemption from the Affordable Care Act of having to provide that particular contraception, we will make sure it's provided to the people who want it at no cost to either the corporation or to the women seeking that contraception. So they effectively, in this particular case, get what they want, the government stepping in and giving them that contraception, which leaves out Hobby Lobby's direct involvement, and it doesn't cost the woman anything more. And that's the first press release on there, that this is an emergency action that's going to be taken by the government. We're going to be following this. And when somebody files for us, we'll immediately look to see if there are people that need help or relief from these religious exemptions by privately owned businesses. So, and it doesn't support the case that women are being denied access. It just changes the method of access. The provider changed, not the access. The government said, we will make sure. Now, if you don't trust the government, if you're going to turn around and say, that's a step just that's too hard with too much bureaucracy, too complicated, well, welcome to the conservative movement. You now don't trust the government to do its job. But if you see that the government has said, we will make sure we're taking care of this, and you believe that the government is capable of doing that, then this should not be a problem as far as a protest of access. You're still going to have access. It's just a matter of provider at that point.
Are there, you know, some Christians are concerned that certain contraception methods are abortifacient. Is that true? Obviously, we've talked about the morning after pill, but things like the IUD or birth control pills, are those things abortifacient?
Okay, and this is interesting because I think Levels becomes uncharitable a couple of times in this op-ed. And one of them is that she paints people who are struggling with this as anti-science. And then she links, by the way, to a couple of different articles. And one of the articles is a really interesting article about how the FDA refuses to remove a warning of what they call the third mechanism. And so here, we'll start with oral contraception, right? So what happens when we're talking about oral contraception is that the FDA gives three mechanisms that are at play with oral contraceptions in their warning labels or in their description of the product. The first is that it prevents ovulation. It won't let the egg out, right? If the egg doesn't come out, it can't be fertilized. So the next thing that it does is it changes the mucus level within the uterus. It makes the uterus an inhospitable place for sperm to pass through. So it makes the uterus produce levels of secretions that would make it difficult for the sperm to make its way into the fallopian tube. So that was how it would frustrate fertilization. So the first two mechanisms are those. And then there's what's called the third mechanism. The third mechanism would be that oral contraceptives, the level of hormones that are released, thin the endometrial lining of the uterine wall, making it inhospitable to implantation. If you believe that life begins at fertilization, as most pro-lifers do, then intentionally frustrating fertilization or implantation for the purpose of ending the life of the embryo, the early embryo, is a problem. It's a direct action with the intent of destroying that life. And so the FDA refuses to remove. Now, there are a bunch of scientists and many medical doctors, and a lot of them Christians that I have talked to, that say the third mechanism, there's absolutely no evidence that it actually has ever happened or that it works that way. And we do have evidence of other things. For example, what they call a rapid thickening of the endometrial lining of the wall there, that it happens when we have breakthrough ovulations. It's like the body decides it's going to get pregnant and it just does everything that it can to prepare the body for a healthy pregnancy in a very rapid time, a time that you wouldn't expect it to be able to happen, that goes far faster than what happens under the normal time that it takes for the lining of that wall to thicken. And so they say, look, we see evidence that that third mechanism doesn't happen. So maybe you guys should remove that from the FDA warning because it's causing confusion. And the FDA just refuses to do it. They said, well, we're not, for whatever reason. And so if that's in an article that she linked to. So you can't at one point say they're silly, they're anti-science for believing that this has some abortifacient property, and then link to an article where you explain why there's confusion out there. But if you do even more research, you're going to find out that there is a lot of confusion about how all of this works anyway. And even though there's a large body of work that seems to be saying that there is no third mechanism with oral contraception, there is still enough people out there that are medical professionals that saying it is a live option and the FDA keeps saying it. So it seems disingenuous to be shocked that people are confused. As a matter of fact, I read a great article in The Atlantic from a young pro-life woman who was talking about how we need clear information about how these things work. As somebody who was evaluating the science of it all, she said it's just the language of what she comes to the conclusion is that there's just a mystery in how some of these things work that we haven't answered. And so we need to be more serious about figuring these things out, or at least being honest that we may never know the answers to. Now let's go to the IUD. Because if you look at the mechanisms for the IUD, and if you don't know what an IUD is, it's a little, you know, for a listener who doesn't know, it's a little piece of plastic, looks like a T, like you mentioned in the New York Times op-ed, it's the pictures of the pop. It's usually surrounded by either a copper coiling, this little piece of plastic that's about the length of the diameter of a quarter, and it's surrounded by copper or progesterone, and it releases either the copper or these hormones into the woman's uterus, and it has two effects. Number one, it does the second mechanism that I talked about a second ago. It makes it very difficult for the sperm to reach the egg. It doesn't suppress ovulation at all, but it makes it an inhospitable environment for the sperm to pass through the uterus. So it makes it difficult for the sperm to reach the egg and the numbers that are necessary to actually fertilize the egg. And then the other mechanism is that it makes the uterus an inhospitable environment for implantation. It has a crazy high effective rate compared to others. It is actually obviously her choice. That if you read the article, it seems like Filipovic, and a lot of times when you're talking about Affordable Care Act, you hear that this was the thing that changed a lot of it was a game changer because it was more expensive and now it's more affordable. But I've read people who are trying to say that, well, maybe even the IUD doesn't have a problem with implantation. Maybe we misunderstand that. It's difficult to believe that effectiveness level of an IUD could be what it is without that second mechanism. And it's much easier to understand how the IUD would be interfering with implantation than it is to understand oral contraception. So there is still some ambiguity there if you research it enough and you read enough. There are still people saying, we don't know that second mechanism with the IUD is actually happening. It may just be that effective at making the uterus an inhospitable place for sperm to pass through. But it seems more likely, based on what we know about the IUD, that the IUD probably does impact implantation. So the end of the story is, there's no way anybody can know for sure, because even if you talk to the medical doctors who are reading this and writing articles about it, and you look at their research, at the end of the day, they're saying there are certain things we just can't know because we can't be there in real time and observe things. And so it's a lot of things that we're having to try to put together from what we know, that the pieces that we do know are happening and what we could predict that would happen there. So I think probably I would say that the jury is well out on oral contraceptives, and there's still a big argument going on there. I think IUD, the idea of coming in now and saying that it probably doesn't have that second mechanism under IUD, it probably doesn't make the uterus an inhospitable place for implantation, that seems harder to believe. That one seems more difficult. I think more likely than not, that second mechanism does appear to be active when you read it. There could be information that comes out in the next few years that changes that altogether, but that's just based on what you're able to see right now. There are certainly things that women take that destroy the lives of unborn children. And then there are certainly contraceptive measures that don't. And then there are some in the middle that we're just not exactly clear what's happening there in reality. We have a lot of things that we think theoretically could be happening, but that we don't know for sure.
Now, you said a moment ago that Filipovic accuses people in the pro-life movement of acting in opposition to science. I don't know if you've seen that meme, you know, if anybody has something they don't agree with from religion, they say, I believe it. Why? Because science, you know. So why is there so much confusion around this? That, you know, basically the pro-life folks are religious people in the dark ages and they are not up to date on the science.
You know, it's a weird thing, right? Because I know so many Christian scientists. And so it's weird that has become the way that we're trying to frame this, as if there were some incompatibility between belief and Christianity and science. I mean, I know brilliant scientists who are Christians and personally know them and trust their faith. I think that it's an easy, you know, there's a lot to go into, right? How rhetoric has degenerated in our culture for multiple reasons, not the least of which is that social media rewards brevity and impact more than it rewards accuracy. Right? I mean, it's if I can say something pithy and short enough that enough people will share, we have a system now that rewards that. You know, that's the thing. And so if I can cast you as anti-science, it's much easier than engaging argument. This is interesting. When you and I first talked about this particular op-ed piece, I expected it to be easier than it was. I had done so much reading, because there's so much nuance and there's so many areas of places where we don't know. And we have to have some epistemic humility about the things that we're saying and about with the strength with which we declare certain things. There's just so much that is difficult to get to the bottom of. And it's so much easier to have an easy out, a scapegoat, or a way of saying things that cast the people that we disagree with in a particular light. And I think that's why the anti-science tag has become so popular nowadays, because first of all, you'll hear a lot. We hear a lot about tribalism as we're trying to understand, is the United States and the world in general, but particularly in the United States, becoming more tribal? Are people so devoted to the tribe they identify with that they are no longer looking at evidence or no longer open to being convinced they're wrong at any particular point? And when you start to stake those positions, those misleading but sometimes strong rhetorical points become something that are easy to fall back on. The idea of saying that any particular group is anti-science by their very nature, I think, is a difficult thing to say, because I know people on all sides of these issues who are very educated with a deep understanding of how science works. But it's just easier, and the world rewards easy right now. It just rewards short, pithy, impactful statements. It doesn't reward, for the most part, deep, thoughtful, long responses that consider things at a deeper level. I gave my daughter a stack of books recently because she's doing her high school senior thesis that she's writing on the morality of abortion, but the legal and moral nature of abortion. A lot of those books, multiple of those books, had to do with medical science. So you will know the science of how this works and all of this works. When I say you're anti-science, it does a lot. It does a lot of work, right? It clarifies my tribe versus your tribe. Like in this particular article, I try to be as gracious as I can. There were moments when I was doing the research and writing the response to this particular article where it felt like this was much more of an ad hominem attack disguised as an argument. This whole thing was just a way of saying they're anti-science and they don't care about women. And then availing lines of argument against that, because some of the things that she says, I think, are particularly harsh given the resources that she provides for evidence. She'll say, this is crystal clear, and then she'll provide you a resource as evidence for her to support her argument that cuts through the clarity and just introduces more vagueness. So she has convictions that aren't supported by the resources that she's providing to us. And I think that just falls back into, it's very easy to paint the other person as flawed than it is to address flaws in their arguments. One requires me to take other people very seriously. The other requires me to demonize them, make them the bad guy outside of my tribe, and make things ultra clear, me good, them bad.
So, you know, she goes through this whole entire article, but, you know, at the end of the day, just let me just ask you the question directly. So would supporting access to contraception ultimately decrease abortion in the United States?
I thought a lot about that. I mean, this article made me ask a lot of questions and to think about it. And I ultimately came down to when, first of all, there's multiple things I was thinking. I was thinking, it's interesting to be a pro-lifer who has dedicated so much of my life to talking about the value of all human beings and that all life ought to be treated with dignity and respect. It's an interesting thing that lately I'm being lectured a lot by the other side that if I really cared about the unborn, I would be doing X, Y, or Z as well. I think they're multiplying things that are necessary for me in my life to demonstrate that I actually care about something, that I feel like my life has been a pretty good indication that I do genuinely care about this, that I'm not being disingenuous in my claims to value human beings, and that I don't take these ideas flippantly, and I'm not a religious nut that's not willing to engage other people, and I do consider this science. So it's been a weird feeling, right? As I was trying to process and take this charge seriously, there was a sense of it that, because she's not the only one and this isn't the only issue, but it has become very popular over the last few years to say, if you really cared about this, you would do this. And the this that I'm not doing always sorts to magically line up with whatever their agenda is. And I had to wrestle with it on this one. And where I came down to as I was thinking it through was there's weak evidence in my mind that the best explanation for the decrease in the abortion rate across the board can be laid at the feet of increased access to contraceptives, and certainly not comprehensive sex education, because I don't even think that, I think that's a term that has no clear definition. So I'm not even sure I understand what they mean when they say that based on what they call comprehensive sex education. So without being able to say, when we look at the big picture, that this decline that we've seen, not from 2011 to 2017, which she's most interested in, but from, you know, 90 on now to today, that this is can be laid at the feet of contraception is unsupported by the evidence that's available to us. It just has to be a much more complex series of events that are going on. And then the other thing that I have, being not convinced by the evidence overall as an evaluation of it, was I thought of a sense of it's like an analogy. If I go to a community with someone and this me and another person standing there, and I said, I look at this community and I see a community that has been hurt badly by desensitization of the value of human life at the earliest stages, that this community has lost sight of the fact that their children's life begins from the moment they come into existence. They've lost sight of the idea that they should be acting in a way to protect life all the way through birth. and then after that, all the way to the end of it. And that desensitization to life's value at any stage puts us at risk to a desensitization of the value of life at other stages as well. If I look at a community and I say, this community needs to learn to treat every human being with dignity and respect, let's do our best to teach them that lesson. And then if we convince enough people, let's have laws that reflect that that's the way that we believe about human life, that we ought to take care of it as best that we can and find ways, creative ways as a community to deal with things like poverty, unexpected pregnancy, families in crisis, all of these things. Don't leave them to say you can get an abortion and move on. Let's find a way to reach that community and be creative as human beings. And if the person that was standing with me responded, or we could just temporarily sterilize this community and they wouldn't be getting pregnant anymore, and as a result of that, abortion problem would be solved. That's the second option I'm being offered here. And I don't see that as a Christian who understands human beings not just as the objects of my agenda in this world. You don't exist as something that I need to manipulate to get the results that I want. When I try to convince somebody the value of human life, I'm not just doing it for the unborn, although they're most at risk when someone has bad ideas about what they are. The embryo or the fetus is most at risk when somebody has a faulty or flawed idea about what they are and what their value is in this world and the moral nature of an action against them. But teaching them the value of human life is good for them. I'm a better man now that I cherish life than I was when I was capable of drawing a line through human beings and saying these human beings matter and these don't. And I know personally, firsthand, how the view that all human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect has caused me to look back on things that I believed prior to becoming this man that I am today and adopting these views that had nothing to do with abortion, that were still grounded in a deep insensitivity about how other human beings ought to be treated. And so one of these methods, one of these ways of addressing our community will hopefully build people into the human beings as Christians more like Christ. We're told, we are commanded at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. We're called into living the example of Christ, to multiply justice, to multiply mercy and grace, to see other human beings as the image bearers of God. And as I reach out to a community and I try to teach them, I'm not just trying to protect the unborn, although that is of primary importance to me because they're most at risk. I'm also trying to help people to become better versions of themselves, to give ourselves a community that cherishes and respects life, to build a culture of life that will affect not just this issue, but others as well. And hopefully for all of us to draw closer to those things that make us the best versions of what we are. And as a Christian, that's truly the person of Christ. The others is such a utilitarian approach. And it doesn't change the value of anything, such that if we removed whatever it was that we were doing to temporarily sterilize them, they would immediately go back to the way they were behaving before because nothing has changed. And so without strong evidence that they are actually able to say the reason that we see this decline is because contraception. And so you can decrease the number of abortions by adding it. Well, maybe you've already met that threshold, right? Maybe you've already found the people who are willing to take that particular contraception. And maybe it's not going to do any more work. Maybe it's not doing all the work. It doesn't seem to be doing all of the work. But what I do know is that a human being who becomes convinced of his or her own value and the value of other human beings and becomes convinced to their core of the preciousness of human beings and the image bearers of God ought to be treated better, if we can change the culture to see that and to act in that way, that is a change that will manifest itself more powerfully than just giving in on certain things to where there are still questions about whether they're harmful to the unborn. There's still questions about whether they're harmful to the people that are availing themselves of that. They require my participation in a system that I want really nothing to do with, in which you can't demonstrate that it's actually the reason that they're seeing this positive effect that you want me to get behind. And as we've said before, it's not even true that all the pro-lifers are against this to beginning. So I thought so long about this. And at the end of the day, I thought, I don't think so. I don't think this is something that the pro-life community needs to feel pressure to jump into because they can't prove what they're saying is true. There's so many factors involved in this. There's so many questions left to be answered about how all of this stuff works. She and many people are pushing most strongly the most problematic form and saying, you have issues with other things. I do have issues with other things, but you're pushing the one thing that we have the least number of answers on that looks like it may be the most problematic for those of us who believe that life begins at fertilization. So I'm I think that when it comes down to the idea of, could you convince me that if we temporarily sterilized a large enough portion of the population, particularly those we believe at risk or had a strange relationship with the medical community, could we decrease the number of abortions, but the number of human beings that are capable of getting pregnant? Logically, of course, yeah, sure, that would work. But what a horrible thing to have to do, rather than to do the hard work of going in there and trying to get dirty and change the culture. Let's see if we can help you develop a new way of looking at this world. Absent of some major evidence that there just isn't there, there's no compelling reason to believe that to be pro-life, I have to be pro-contraception from the government or free access to contraception or to support all of these other things. Because however it must save and may serve their purposes to cast the pro-life movement in a particular light, and to overgeneralize and to paint with a broad brush, it's not clear to me or to anybody else that I talk to about this, that what they're offering will have the results that they're saying it will have. And it is clear that a lot of people are being asked to participate in things where they see moral compromise, whether it's there or not, they believe themselves to be morally compromised. And where at the end of the day, you've done nothing to change the problem that is most present in our world, which is that we have to learn to create a culture that values human beings and that we treat them with the dignity and respect they ought to be treated with across the board, and that we listen and hear them and respond to them, and that we stop seeing human beings as a problem. Human beings operate together as a problem solver for big issues. We should not see other human beings as a problem to be eliminated.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note than our discussion today, I have a couple of fun rapid-fire questions for Jay so that our listeners can get to know our authors a little bit better. So, Jay, what is the best sandwich?
You know, that changes, right? I mean, I'm one of those guys that I change a lot. Right now...
Well, today. Okay, what's the best sandwich today?
There is a sandwich at the Honey Baked Ham store down the road. I guess it's their honey baked ham club sandwich. Right now I couldn't get enough of that. It's horrible for me, but man, it is just, something about it just makes me so happy. So my wife will take me down there and get it for me every once in a while.
And spring is coming up and spring cleaning. So what is something that you own that you should really throw out?
Oh my gosh. So many clothes I got to get rid of and give away to people. My family are one of those people that every time I try to get rid of clothes, they have emotional attachment to clothes. They remember when they bought it, who gave it to them, where they wore it. You can't get rid of that. Well, we have a small house, people. We can't carry, you know, 50 years of clothes in this house. It just can't be how we operate. So I need to divest my house of so many clothes. So much clothes need to move out of my house.
Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to episode 274 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Jay Watts. He has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. It is responding to an op-ed in the New York Times. His article is called Flipovic's Confused Claim That the Pro-Life Community Must Champion Contraception. You can read Jay's article for free at our website, equip.org, if you subscribe to our journal. If you don't already subscribe, you can easily do that at equip.org for $33.50. Thank you.